Love, Lust, and Laughter with Dr. Diana Wiley and Billy Sage, Fridays at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, the host for Love, Lust, and Laughter. And with me, again this week, is my guest co-host, Brian Brewer.
Hello, Diana, and hello, everyone.
Hello. Brian is my close friend and a Pacific Northwest business consultant, but he knows a lot about a lot of things, and that's just one reason why I've asked him to take Billy Sage's place, who is still, of course, grieving for his wife, who sadly passed on from cancer. And this week, we have Dr. Elizabeth Ray Larson. Hello,
hi,
Ray.
How you doing?
Good. Ray is the director of the Seattle Institute for Sex Therapy Education and Research, and I have now been affiliated with the Institute for over 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Although Ray and I have known each other for many years, and I heard you present this Beyond Romance, an erotic enhancement curriculum for people in long-term committed relationships. I first heard you present that in Cuba in 2003. Remember Cuba?
I do.
and then again in 2006 in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. In Cuba, it was the World Congress for Sexology, and in Las Vegas, it was Quad S, wasn't it? Or was it AFECT?
No, it was Society for Scientific Study of Sexuality.
Yes, yes. So what I really like, Ray, her clients call her Elizabeth. Others call her Dr. Larson. I call her Ray, R-A-E. So I don't think I can change for the sake of this show, Ray.
Okay.
And what I really like about Beyond Romance, well, many, many things, but of course, nothing is more fulfilling than being in a successful love and sexual relationship. And what I like is that Beyond Romance kind of takes control. It helps people take control over their love and sex lives, because it seems like we grow up on fairy tales and movies in which, you know, somehow magical forces help people find their soulmates with whom they just effortlessly then live happily ever after.
That's it.
That's it. So,
and there's no evidence for happily ever after.
Yes.
I think most listeners can probably identify with that.
Yeah.
Yes. So I wanted, while we're paused, before I have you give sort of an introduction about your curriculum, Beyond Romance, Brian will give this number too as we go along. If any of you listening out there have a comment or a question, please feel free to call toll-free 888-874-4888, 874-4888. So, Ray, would you give us an overview of this wonderful Beyond Romance program that you have, that you've been developing for many years now?
We have, and actually, I call it a curriculum, and it is designed for couples in long-term committed relationships who want to strengthen or enhance their erotic connection.
And you prefer to use erotic connection rather than
I've used sexual relationship over the years because that's the language we're supposed to use. But in fact, what I realize is that in the long-term committed relationship, it's about an experience that is, you could have sex and not have it. And you could have an erotic connection and be very happy with what happened and not, quote unquote, have sex. So I'm sort of biased to going for the sort of energetic description of what the experience is that people are looking for, but it's that experience of feeling bonded to each other. And
you use the word energetic, and Brian, you know a lot about energy.
Oh, yes. Well, I want to hear more of what Ray has to say about the program or the curriculum.
Yes.
And, well, so anyway, what we have done over the years is collect lots of different kinds of exercises that help promote some of the kind of fundamental skills that it takes to keep intimacy alive. And I just honestly believe that more people would have been taught these if they'd been taught realistically about how long-term relationships work, but they weren't. They were taught they work by magic. And so the whole, in some ways we are doing more and more research that elucidates what makes relationships work, which ones work and which ones crash. And if I were going to put it, I would take some of the Gottman research to put it most simply.
Mm-hmm.
Relationships in the long run thrive if there is mutual respect and attunement.
Attunement is such a good word and such a...
Attunement in some
when
ways...
When it works, it is almost magical when it works. But you've worked at it.
But in long-term relationships, most couples, if you ask them who have gotten to this state, will tell you they've been through trials and tribulations. They've had crises of confidence. They've had disasters that they had to struggle through or not together.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
most people in the long-term relationship have been tried by fire in some way or another, and they've stuck together. Many people didn't stick.
Many people didn't. And there's probably been along the way, aside from the ups and downs, lots of accommodation, lots of times of being vulnerable. But
for the ones who stick,
for the ones who survive, yes.
It's right. It's that they keep finding the way to cherish each other.
And I so like that word, cherish. It's kind of an old-fashioned word, but it implies
We basically set out to help couples develop. I mean, we know, for example, from some of the laboratory research that having people do eye gazing makes them generally feel connected to each other. Having, you know, if people are not feeling cheerful and they smile, it actually cheers them up. It's weird stuff that these behaviors, in fact, have feedback systems to the nervous system that can work in the opposite direction than what you think. You don't have to wait to be happy to smile. If you smile, typically you will give yourself a little bit of a lift.
Now, and I think if you smile and also make your eyes twinkle, that even adds a little more. Because
yeah.
it actually changes, as I understand it, the autonomic nervous system.
Yeah, what you're doing in one sense is going through the physical motions of certain kinds of experiences, and what's interesting is the nervous system follows you rather than thinking that's phony.
Yeah.
I was just reading some research recently. Now, I'm not a neuroscientist, so
that's okay.
I can't quote
me neither.
This, but I was reading about mirror neurons. Is this related to this?
That's related particularly to the interpersonal situation. Those are the kinds of neurons that when we see somebody else do something, our empathic response actually fires neurons that match what that person was doing.
Yeah,
so if
I
they're leaning over...
Right.
We literally fire with them, and sometimes you can actually see people who are empathic doing that. If you watch people watching a sports event, they actually sort of move with the action.
I see this all the time and experience it myself on the dance floor. When two people are dancing together, it's just it's really an automatic response to somewhat mirror what the other person is doing.
Right, and when it gets interfered with, it usually gets interfered with by something that I think is properly called self-consciousness in a way that's destructive. You start to worry about whether you're doing it right, and it will fall apart.
I have an example of that I pull out from many, many years ago when I was 19 years old and I was a summer camp counselor and I was in charge of music and drama and dance for these kids that ranged from 7 to 13.
Oh, what a lovely age.
Well, yeah, and they were in three different groups. I put on some music, I had them draw how it was as they listened, and then I had them dance it. Well, by the time the boys got to be about 10, they couldn't do it. They could not dance it.
Not a manly thing, right.
No. The girls could. They could go out there and dance around with scarves. And
yeah, but that's permitted, right.
Yes. So, the self-consciousness is a big thing. So you talked about... Mutual.
Well, let me say a couple more general things. I think, in one sense, over the years, I've thought about again and again, what is it we're teaching people? I think probably the most important core thing we're teaching people is how to stay present.
Mm-hmm.
How to not wander off or divide your attention or, you know, superficially act like you're there but be off somewhere else in your head. And that's not actually, that's a skill that I think benefits lots of different things in life. And I think the closest approximation to that that's now becoming more and more available are training and mindfulness. Because that is what being present is. It's the same as what mindfulness courses are teaching. And there's lots of ways to learn how to do it. So we introduced things like being present in breath, being present in eye gazing, being present in touch, because those are fundamental to the sensual bond that people have. You know, we literally went through those modalities. And it doesn't mean we don't do words, but these are the things that are in addition to words.
The staying mindful is especially important, as you and I know, Ray, from working with women who have low desire and or are pre-orgasmic or anorgasmic.
Right.
And they're so often multitasking. They don't really want to be there.
Haunted by trying to get something done they can't get done, or trying not to get something done that seems to happen. And I mean, in many ways, I think if women grow up in a sex-negative society like ours, it's hard for them not to be somewhat haunted, let alone if they have trauma in their history.
Yes.
That makes sexuality a dangerous place, you know, even more so than it might be for somebody else. And I think it's very hard to have a good time when you're haunted or when you can't focus, when focusing just brings up too many confusing and conflicting feelings.
There are elements for some of PTSD where they will have flashbacks on a particularly awful sexual...
Certainly in the extreme, and over the years we certainly have seen that come in and be part of what people needed to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But in many ways, even if people are quote-unquote comfortable, learning how to tune in and how to pay attention and how not to get distracted, that's a skill that takes practice. And one of the things about this curriculum is that it requires repetitious practice of the sort of core skills, and then you get to sort of figure out which ones fit you best. But you never quit doing it. If you really, in the same way, you never quit going to do physical workout if you want to stay physically healthy.
It's and it becomes really
kind of
integrated
thing.
Then in your life. And don't you talk about how it's really hard to change a habit, and that it takes about 8 weeks
to internalize? Yes, we're trying to change somebody's habits and have it become almost automatic, it's going to take at least 8 weeks of daily repetitions before that's likely to happen. Before it isn't likely to fall away if they quit. And so in many ways, that's what this stuff is giving people. We don't actually make people practice daily in this work, because realistically it's not possible. So in some ways it happens, those 8 weeks have to happen over months instead, so that you get enough time for repetition. But for most people, those sort of core skills, like what does it mean to really be with your partner when you're with them as opposed to half there? That, you know, whether we're doing eye gazing or having people breathe together or doing movement together or music. Because music is another way. The word attunement actually really is good with a musical metaphor. When you're attuned to somebody, your work is in harmony with each other.
Yes, yes.
It's not necessarily in monotone. It may be in point and counterpoint, but it harmonizes. And that is, I think, again, back to mirror neurons, that is where some of this brain research is illuminating how this works.
Mm-hmm.
But people have actually had practices that go back thousands of years that is the work, even if they couldn't prove it. So a lot of this stuff that we have picked up is, you know, is old, like mindfulness is Buddhist, basically.
Yes, it is.
There are Taoist practices. There's actually even monotheistic practices that come out of laying on of hands. So these practices are scattered in many ways throughout philosophies and religions. And people have just been that wise. They've stumbled on how to make it work. But I don't think that's a part of our collective knowledge in this culture.
No, and that's why the work that you did in developing Beyond Romance, where you admit that you have freely borrowed from practices of ancient disciplines of Tantra and Tao, and you've developed a skill-focused education program, skills that, as you said, need to be practiced. So you have the mindful breathing and being present and focusing and clearing the air and raising energy and rhythm and harmony and devotion and play. Play. One of your premises for this program, the first one is sex is a form of play.
Yes, not a form of work.
Well, let's hope so.
But for so many people, the experience about worrying about sexuality, whether it's worrying about living up to some imaginary standard or, you know, that worrying stuff turns sex into work. And in some ways, our exercises in this curriculum are homework. And that's the place to put work, is learn how to play the instrument. Don't put the work in when you're trying to perform. And by the time you're in the concert hall, you know, delivering this masterpiece, you want to have those habits well trained. So you do your homework in repetitious practice. In the same way, if you're going to go skiing, you want to be in a certain, you want to have certain skills, you want to be in shape, and then you can have fun.
And you don't want
fun about skiing down the mountain when you don't know what you're doing.
No.
Maybe there is, but I can't see it.
And you don't, as you said to me earlier, you don't want to hold the hand of somebody who doesn't know how to ski as you go down the mountain.
Right, and even more than not doing it yourself. You don't want to do it with another neophyte. That's not going to improve the outcome. And so, to some extent, you have to develop the necessary skills to have fun at what you're playing at.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't develop them when you're playing, because that turns play into work. So that's why, in many ways, homework is an important thing to separate from sex or making love or being intimate itself, is that homework is a place of learning and exploration. It's got different goals than playing in the pure, simple sense.
We have case consultation meetings every Monday from 11 to 1. And
that we do.
And I've benefited so much. I've learned so much from you, Ray. And
well, thank you.
And we talk about these sorts of things as we review cases, and it's been invaluable. One of the things that we talk about is that discrepancy of desire is the most common presenting problems, and that it's typically the woman with a lower desire.
Probably about 9 out of 10 cases, it's
mm-hmm.
the woman. And then 1 out of 10, it's not. It's the man.
Mm-hmm.
And typically when it's the woman, there are different clusters of issues that are likely to come up than when it's a man.
Yeah,
the men and women
that
are different mm-hmm. enough that even mm-hmm. though we both have a sexuality and we interact with each other with it, we're not really, it's a fundamentally, profoundly different thing in the two halves of the species. And I think we have to respect that. In some ways, we always want the other person to be more like us, because that would be convenient.
Oh, of course.
And in the long run, actually, I don't think it'd be that interesting. But
so, Ray, how do you think those fundamental differences between masculine and feminine contribute to that that 9-to-1 imbalance?
Well, I think in some ways, sex is a core identity issue for men. And therefore, when sex isn't working, they work harder at fixing it.
Mm-hmm.
They will. So even that 1 out of 10, with a lot of women, when sex becomes difficult, they actually are willing to kind of give it up. Not all women, but a significant proportion of women, if they're not feeling sexual, it's kind of like not being hungry. It's not a problem unless it bothers somebody else. And so most women come into therapy worried about their partner, because they're depriving their partner of sexuality. They don't come in themselves kind of with a sense of the urgency for themselves, whereas a lot of the guys, it's the sex not working itself that is just driving them nuts.
That's interesting.
And some of it, I think is beyond culture. I think sex is very likely sort of a core identity issue for the male half of at least mammals. Let's not speak about any other species.
Okay.
But those of us, you know, who are the egg layer, not the egg layers, but the, you know, egg carriers.
Egg carriers.
That somehow it's different, those two have, that's a different enough set of needs and design questions.
Well, the imperative to inseminate is extremely strong in mammals. That's
yeah, and I think when guys lose desire, they are really distressed about it in a way that women are usually distressed about hurting their partner's feelings. And that's just such a fundamental difference.
It really is. I see it prominently in the oldest couple I have in my practice now, and they're 78, and they've been married almost 55 years. And she's had cancer, so she has no desire, and he still has lots of desire.
Uh-huh.
And he has learned to back off to give her a little space, and then she's found her voice to sometimes be compassionate and give him a hand job or maybe even try to have intercourse.
Well, and what
because
I would say,
and to touch yeah. more, just a touch more.
In some ways, yes, bring yourself to that intimate event in a way that you can.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways what's important is you have to be comfortable with what you're doing. You don't have to desire it, but in some ways this is very crucial to our curriculum, where what we're really trying to get people to do is be completely present and conscious in what they're doing. So I would encourage her, if she were going to give him a hand job, as you said, to really be fully present, not to do it with half her attention.
Exactly, exactly.
And that's a very subtle difference, because a lot of times people go, oh, okay, I'll just do that.
Yeah, but duty, obligation.
Nobody wants that attitude coming at them. It's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaves the event having a different impact than the one that it can have if it leaves you feeling connected to each other. But sometimes, in part, it's because the women sometimes choose to do things that they don't really want to do, and they actually have to be more honest with themselves about what's doable and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't do self-sacrifice. You can do a kind of devoted commitment, but you cannot lie about your own reactions and then think it's going to work.
That's
so
true.
It's that authenticity that's kind of critical. And and when you see couples in long-term relationships who are still happy and bonded with each other, there is that sense of being known by your partner and having your partner know who you really are and honor you as that, not honor you to want to be somebody else.
I agree with you. In this couple's case, she really felt compassion for him because she knows that he suffers and when he isn't touched enough. So of course they're doing lots more non-sexual touching too, which
helps
him.
There's plenty of evidence that he's going to have less pain and discomfort, that his mood is going to be better, his survival rate is going to go up if he has a sexual expression somehow possible.
Yes, and this is apparently especially true for women. In 1921, a Stanford University psychologist named Lewis Terman, you know the Terman study, you were at Stanford, not in 1921. But
not in 1921. I'm getting old, but I'm not that old.
Yeah, right. Anyway, he recruited 1,500 elementary school students, and he began an academic inquiry that would last 8 decades. Well, they called it the Longevity Project, and from their findings, the point that most interested in me is that you need to have more fun in bed. And almost 60 years before Sex and the City, Terman got women to talk about their sexual satisfaction and the average amount of time that they spent being intimate with their husbands and the frequency of their orgasms. And the records show that the women who most often reached climax most often lived longer. Yay!
Right. And
had so much more fun doing it.
That's right. It's a great way to exercise your cardiovascular system.
Yes. Yes, it is.
It's good for you. It really is.
It is so good, and it's really much more fun than walking on a treadmill for an hour.
Although, one of the things, if people are working on creating this kind of intimate space that the Beyond Romance curriculum teaches,
mm-hmm.
I will tell people to run up and down stairs or get on a treadmill just to get their heart rate up. Of course, it could just tell them to put on some music and dance.
Yes, you talk about that, dancing together.
And that, you know, to do that successfully, you have to have some common music that you both like.
Right.
Or agree to take turns.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes, you know, that's in part, the critical stuff is about honoring some of the differences.
Mm-hmm.
Just
mm-hmm.
because you like this music or this kind of sexual behavior or whatever doesn't mean your partner has to like it.
Well, that's a pretty good segue into your premise number six. And, Brian, you were going to talk a little bit about the individuation thing.
Well, you've already, Ray, you already mentioned about intimacy and, you know, being able to not accommodate your partner, but recognize that there's differences and being, you know, being open and vulnerable to say what works for you and be open to hearing what your partner says as well. And that, to me, you know, like, I've studied some of David Schnarch's stuff and his idea about individuation. Yeah, his quote about true intimacy and, you know, wanting to, I'm not on this planet to be here for you, I'm here to just reveal myself. And
mm-hmm.
maybe someday, you know, we'll know that we knew each other. That's the essence of it. I'm paraphrasing.
Right, but, I mean, we are an individualistic culture, and to some extent that's a very different life experience than cultures that are more family-oriented or community-oriented.
Right.
And it could be that in some of those other cultures there's a different road to commitment. But with us, with Western culture, a lot of individuation, a lot of the ability to stay somehow a separate person within a committed relationship has a lot to do with having the eroticism be satisfying. That people who lose themselves in the relationship, I think, can probably have a way to eroticism, but I don't think it's as easy a course.
Hmm.
I think that, you know, having a partner who is separate from you in some ways is a little scary. You know, you don't have any guarantees and all that. But
well, it goes against a lot of our cultural norms, too.
Yes,
yeah. Two hearts beating as one, and that's
right. And that we went to the same place when we had this ecstatic experience. And in fact, if you really debrief people, they may both have had an ecstatic experience, but they didn't go to the same place.
Right.
And so, to some extent, that's romanticism that kind of contaminates. And I think it misleads people into a kind of intimacy that's sameness rather than individual difference.
Do you remember, I'm going to ask Ray, because if you're more likely to remember, because it, again, was a Stanford study, I would say probably 25 years ago, where they took 200 couples who by self-report were happily married, and they were all married at least 20 years. And what they all had in common was a real respect for the other's uniqueness and trust. They had mm-hmm. some separate friends and some separate hobbies, and they enjoyed hearing about the other's separateness mm-hmm. and other friends. And there was trust that, you know, that they, and not jealousy about the other having some separate friends.
What I think is interesting in most couples who come into treatment, want to come into sex therapy
mm-hmm.
or sexual enhancement work, they usually are in such relationships. That's what's critical to saving the relationship, is that sex may have it doesn't save sex necessarily to have mutual respect, because time can erode sexual commitment, and if you don't know how to keep it alive, it gets stale, it gets old, it gets boring, and, you know, lots of those things are very natural. But the people who can reverse that are the people who are dedicated to each other. And a lot of that is about feeling a unique kind of respect for their partner. that's what makes it possible to do sex therapy. In some ways, I think a lot of times I see way too much mental health information that suggests that if you get couples to resolve their conflicts over money or parenting or whatever, whatever, sex will take care of itself. And there's just no evidence that that's true.
We're going to continue this discussion and present more evidence, including a very controversial premise that behavior change precedes attitude change, when we come back from the break. Brian, would you give the call-in number and encourage people to call if they've got
Have any questions for today, please call. The number is toll-free, 1-888-874-4888.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Show brings you the hidden truths behind the stories that affect us all and gives you the information you need to build freedom, community, and a much better world. This is Bert Cohen. My past shows include The New Media Power of Comcast, Socialism for Wall Street Only, and How to Empower Your Own Community Over Corporate Interests. For archives, go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and listen to The Bert Cohen Show every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.com. The Bert Cohen Show. There's really nothing like it.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the Mama Grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude, Thursdays, 8 p.m., Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Allison Rose Levy. I've been a health journalist for 25 years. I'm currently blogging on the Huffington Post. After more than two decades of studying, talking about, exchanging, and reporting on integrative well-being and collective psychology, I think we're ready to step up to the next level. On Connect the Dots, we're going to reach beyond the merely individual look at health to look at the community, societal, and global level of what we need to address to better our health. Please join me Saturdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I look forward to dialoguing with you.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Dr. Diana Wiley, the host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, back with you all. My guest co-host today is Brian Brewer, and our guest is Dr. Elizabeth Ray Larson, the director for the Seattle Institute for Sex Therapy Education and Research. The website is www.sex, you know how to spell that, tx.com. So sextx.com, and you can read more about the Institute, and also you will find there that we have free consultation from 9 to 10 Pacific Standard Time in the mornings.
And on the telephone.
On the telephone. And I typically answer those calls, but Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays.
And I'm your Monday-Friday person.
And the Monday-Friday, so you'll get probably really valuable advice if you call in between 9 and 10.
Call and talk to both of us.
Yes, and you can do that, of course, today. The number again, Brian, is...
Yes, please call into this show. We'd love to chat with listeners. Toll-free, 888-874-4888.
And just thank you. And just before the break, we were talking about one of the premises behind your program, Beyond Romance, is that behavior change precedes attitude change. Now, what's difficult for some about that, Ray?
I think it is commonly thought that you have to psych yourself up for something first before you do it. And I think most people who have ever done an exercise program or dieted or done any kind of behavior change have probably found out that, no, what you do is you start doing it, and then you begin to encounter what the problems are. You know, somebody said, I'm trying to figure out why I drink so I can quit drinking, and somebody else said, quit drinking, it'll scream at you. And I think in many cases, we wait to feel like doing something, and you can wait forever.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you can engage in the right intervention behavior and begin to move yourself into what it was that you wanted to get done in the first place. But sometimes the real trick is figuring out how to get it started, how to launch it.
And sometimes the therapist has to be the inspiration.
Yeah, and that's what structured homework is there to do.
Yeah.
Whether you buy it in a self-help book or whether you get it from a therapist or a coach or some other teacher, the structure is there. In the same way that when you go to a physical therapist, they give you exercises to take home and do, because that's where the change happens, is in that repetitious practice.
And I know it's been your experience, because we've talked about this in case consultation meetings, it certainly has been mine, that couples that do their homework just progress so much faster.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
And then they graduate with big smiles and a much improved love and sexual relationship.
And sometimes the couples who, sometimes the barriers to doing homework are lifestyle. People are working way too many hours, they really don't have enough time together. And that can defeat the work, because it isn't about not doing your homework because you don't feel like it. You're not doing your homework because you don't have enough time in your life to build this relationship. Those are hard facts to kind of grapple with about life's priorities.
Yes, and then it ultimately leads, especially for couples with little children, to two syndromes, DINS, double income, no sex, and TTFS syndrome, which is too tired for sex.
Mm-hmm.
And these are just devastating for couples. And the longer they're celibate, or practically celibate, the more they won't want to have sex.
The harder it gets.
It gets. Conversely, couples that are having a lot of hot sex want to have more, because, my God, does it feel good. You get all those endorphins and the oxytocin, and your life is just better.
You know it has health benefits.
Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a good place to begin to discuss your basic skills for creating intimacy that are in your Beyond Romance curriculum.
And actually, I would take the, you know, they're sort of listed in our course book.
Mm-hmm.
In one sense, these skills are constantly renewable, but if I were going to put them in an order, I would probably put them in the order they're listed. And the first thing you have to do is overcome the barriers to intimacy, what we were just talking about.
Right.
If you really are living a lifestyle where you're too tired for sex, then there's a lifestyle change that has to be considered, and you can decide it's not worth it, but you can't then be surprised that you don't have enough space to build intimacy. So barriers to intimacy can be internal, psychological or interpersonal, you know, relationship resentments that may need to be dealt with, or it can be out there in the environment. I mean, that literally sometimes people have low desire because there is something wrong with their bodies. And we're only going to be able to make a certain amount of impact on that if we don't address what some of those things are, too.
And that's why, as sex therapists, if the person with a presenting sexual problem has not been to an MD or a naturopath, we suggest that they go get the physical rules, issues ruled out.
Right. I mean, probably the most common killer of sexual functioning for modern society is diabetes.
Yes.
And sometimes the sexual dysfunction is the first sign that diabetes is striking.
Hmm.
And so it can be terribly important to pay attention to things that are barriers that are, you don't necessarily have that much control over without some sort of expert help.
I remember when Viagra was approved by the FDA in April of 1998.
Got a good memory.
Well, I remember I had a radio show at that time, and right after that I had a urologist on the program, and anyway, so at that time there were lots of guys who were racing to get Viagra, as they do now often, on the internet, and that's not a safe way to do it. And as this urologist pointed out then, and it's still a very strong and important message, is that the man really needs to ideally be checked by a urologist.
Really, yeah. To have, and actually, a lot of online stuff. Online is a miracle, but it's also just a breeding ground for fraud.
Yes.
There is no, if you order from some unknown medical house, there's no guarantee that what says is in your product is even in there, let alone that something dangerous is not in there. So it is true. Be friends with your family doctor, your naturopath, or your physician. Don't short-circuit that that first step. But let's, you know, assuming that people are paying attention, that they keep the air clear between them, that they are tending to the quality of their own health and the quality of their relationship's health, then the next skill is that skill of being present that I talked about before.
Being present, yes.
And it sounds so simple. And it really is quite hard. And one of my favorite ways to sort of start people on learning what it is to be present is to just have them close their eyes and count off 20 deep breaths without losing count. And that's a good way to practice just getting the experience of what it means to be truly focused on what you said you were focused on and not letting your mind wander.
Do you ever do that in session with your couples?
I do, some. And most of the time I actually send people home to practice it, because I want, even if I demonstrated it in the session, I want people to go, that's a skill too. When you first try it, you're going to start over all the time. You're going to lose count constantly. And then you'll get to a place where you can do five of them in a row and count up to 100 and not lose count. That's the skill. And
takes practice.
It just takes practice. And it is a great skill for people to do when they start doing performance anxiety, what Masters and Johnson called spectatoring during sex.
I
just say, close your eyes and count 20 deep breaths. Remove yourself from your interaction for the moment, but also remove yourself from whatever it is your mind was just doing. And if you've practiced the skill, it'll be there for you. You won't even need 20 to get present.
And
sometimes you can learn how to...
Because of distorted body image issues, women usually
then
have
women
much
worry
more of a
about
problem.
How they look. Right?
Yeah, much more of a problem with this than the spectating.
Well, it's a kind of spectatoring.
Yes.
I mean, guys may worry about whether they're performing, but women worry about how they look, and they do have a catastrophic ability to imagine the most unpleasant image of their own body.
And from the male's point of view, what do you think is that's about, and do you think it matters that much to most men, Brian?
In terms of how one's body looks?
I think it matters some.
I mean, it matters some, of course.
Of course.
And having somebody not happy in their body really matters a lot.
Yeah, because then you're not going to have the enthusiastic lover.
Well, but, it's the inner confidence that really makes the difference.
Now, one of the things I actually encourage women to do if they're having body image challenges is get themselves a beautiful piece of silky fabric. And I probably mean real silk, because that feels good. Fabric that feels good around your skin. And drape your body if you're so worried about how your hips look. but get something that feels good. Not, it isn't about how it looks. It is with your partner. Your partner's going to like it if it looks pretty.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's scratchy or it doesn't feel sensuous or you don't feel enclosed by it,
yes,
it won't work for most women.
Yes.
And so I literally say something as simple as a long piece of silk fabric that you can just wrap yourself in.
Mm-hmm.
And let that, you know, make you feel more able to be present.
And more sensual, because you're plugging into that sensuality
of
the silk.
And women, lots and lots, I mean, I'm not saying men don't. Women love texture and touch. And so that's why I say it's really important. Don't get cheap satin and have it scratch your skin. You have to get something that feels good.
Yes, and splurge a little.
Yeah.
That's why I appreciate La Perla lingerie over and above Target.
Right. You aren't getting a commission, are you?
No.
Too bad. But it really is true. A single piece of lingerie that feels wonderful is worth 10 pieces that you hardly ever like to put on or want to take off right away because they don't feel right.
Mm-hmm. Unless you've set up a sex scene where you want your partner to tear your clothes off,
well,
then you buy something
then
cheap.
Then get the cheap stuff and go for breakaway. Right.
Breakaway.
I was going to say, do remember to snip some crucial seams, because otherwise having your clothes ripped off is really hard work.
You know, with Billy Sage being absent, we have to remember the third part of the title of this show.
Right.
Laughter. So it's good that we're laughing.
And so then I'm going to go on to the next one. The third skill is what I call bearing witness.
And this is an important one. So
has a religious sound to it, because that's where you'll hear that expression. And I do think it has a spiritual component.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways it's a reflection of that mutual respect we've been talking about, that ability to see and speak your own truth and to hear your partner's truth without distorting it. Not only to be seen and heard, but to hear and see is a tremendously important commitment. And I think that literally is why, if you can clear the air, you do it successfully by bearing witness, by being present to the other person's reality in such a way that makes them feel complete with the communication. And it's not the same as being agreed with. It isn't like, well, now that I understand that you really don't like this, I'm going to run out and change how I feel. I may or may not be able to bear witness beyond hearing that that's an issue for you. I want to go back to body image. I think it does matter to guys in long-term relationships, and I'm not saying it doesn't matter to women, but it matters to guys when their partner changes bodies.
Yes, and if the woman gets, for example, too fat.
It's inevitable in one sense. If you go on to have kids and all that stuff, their bodies do change. And there's no way, I don't think people ought to have to lie about that and you know, say, oh, no, it doesn't bother me at all. I think in some ways, if you can have an honest dialogue that is like this bearing witness, where you really can feel what matters to your partner, then there's a chance you can do some things about it rather than everybody having to pretend there's no big deal going on here.
That elephant, so-called, in the middle of the living room.
Yeah, and a lot of times it is about weight gain. We all put on those pounds as we age, and and it's good for us to not put them on. I mean, for the most part, we do better if we stay a little leaner. But I think that that kind of issue needs a place where it gets heard as opposed to shoved under the rug.
I did read a survey of, I've forgotten how many, it was a fairly large survey, that men actually would prefer, ideally, the woman, their woman, we're not talking obesity here, to be 5 pounds heavier than the woman thought her man wanted her to be.
Yeah, women typically over-evaluate. That, you're right.
Yeah.
For the most part, women have a more negative body image than the rest of the world sees them as.
And if
Ray, do you have any techniques you use for helping couples to learn how to do this bearing witness?
To some extent, the best way to do that, I mean, we basically would use coaching and or having the therapist there as a mediator so that you get that kind of communication started. In some ways, what I have people do is practice active listening.
Right.
And get good at it about neutral subjects before they tackle anything very important. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I really do think that I want to be in the room when I start pulling these worms out of the can. Because I do think that people's cultural expectations don't really allow for this kind of honesty.
Well, right. It can trigger a lot of reactions.
So in some ways, and actually what I would say about this whole curriculum that we've got is this is basically a curriculum for couples who feel pretty committed to each other and pretty comfortable in their own skin. This is not a mental health program for people who are really grappling with trauma or PTSD. You know, that has to come first.
Yes.
You have to treat PTSD before you can even move into this arena where you do something like bearing witness at the edge of where the issues are in an intimate relationship.
And if any of our live listeners, and we know many of you don't listen live, you check in by Monday and it's archived, but if any of our live listeners want to share their own story or want to get some advice from Dr. Larson, the number is 888-874-4888, and we've got maybe 8 minutes left on the show.
And I think we shook hands, and I'll be back on April 8th. So
yes.
Some of these people listening to it.
Yes,
later.
And we will continue to talk about these things on April 8th, part two, with Dr. Elizabeth Ray Larson, the director of the Seattle Institute for Sex Therapy Education and Research. And the website is www.sextx.com, S-E-X-T-X.com. And we'll just
Ray,
repeat.
I'd like to hear
yes.
more about, you know, in the little bit of time we have left, maybe we can cover some of these other basic skills
sure.
we've talked about.
There's really three more that I think of consciously.
Mm-hmm.
And we have alluded to each of these in some ways. One's raising energy. We know from research studies that if you get your heart rate up, you are potentially more available to lots of emotional responses. With an elevated heart rate, you could turn that to an erotic event. You could also get annoyed and, you know, angry. You could get sad. Elevating people's heart rate intensifies their emotional experience. So you can mechanically, or, you know, with your own knowledge, elevate your heart rate in a context that supports eroticism, as opposed to fighting or anything else that might be less desirable. But literally putting people on a treadmill can replicate some of these findings. I say dancing naked in the living room probably puts the mood in the right place,
mm-hmm.
as well as elevates the heart rate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's so raising energy is one of the things. And there are many other ways to do that, and I'd be glad to come back and elaborate on that more when we talk next time.
Right.
Yes, I think that would be valuable. Do you want to speak about devotional acts?
Yeah, I do.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to try and get both of these last two in. Devotional
yeah.
acts are literally the kind of end product of exploring ritual togetherness and finding out what's meaningful to both of you. So devotional acts are little bits of theater. And actually, it's been my experience that both men and women love theater, but I think women love it more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if they can elevate it to doing theater as theater rather than making life too dramatic, I kind of think that's a better choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should always remember there's a difference between theater and drama in personal relationships.
Yes. Ah, good point, Brian.
And devotional acts are some very quiet theater, but we have various rituals that we have captured in our curriculum here that are things that people can practice with each other and practice bringing devotion into the interaction. It's a conscious choice to actually center yourself on devotion first and then do whatever the next behavior is. And we have various exercises from that. And anybody who's interested who contacts us through our website, we'll be happy to send you all the exercises. I don't necessarily guarantee they'll all flow smoothly for you, but we're happy to share the knowledge. So people
yeah,
should feel free to ask us.
Sometimes it really is useful to have a coach kind of directing
oh, yeah.
you.
I mean, honestly, I do think that sometimes, it's not enough to read this off the page. There's
yes.
a certain amount of
yes.
skill training that does help. And the final thing that we encourage people to do is what I call reflection. It is to have ways to look back on, think about, and be kind of introspective about what worked and what didn't work and how you feel and what's going on. Journaling is, of course, a classic form of reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And often is journaling alone in the hands of a skilled person who's been taught how to journal really holds its own with psychotherapy half the time. That merely the taking a moment and looking inward and noticing what's true for you and thinking about it face-to-face rather than ducking it lets people make really better choices and have more power in their life.
And be sure to date the journal entries.
Ah, good point. Yes.
Because then you can go back.
You can say, my God, I've felt this way since 1906. Yeah.
Yeah. And... or, look at the distance I've come, mm-hmm. Bravo. And that's about self-soothing and self-validation.
And I encourage people to keep their journals private. I think
yes.
I think we do need a place where we tell the bald truth to ourselves. And the rest of the world doesn't. We can tell them about it if we want to later, mm-hmm. but I don't think, intimacy as full divulgence and tell everybody everything, I think is a phony version of intimacy. I think intimacy is a real connection between yourself and another, not dumping your internal experience on your partner.
And one other clarification, Ray, about reflection. I presume that you're advocating that couples find a time other than during sex to reflect on what happened.
Absolutely. I tell people during sex, please do not discuss it. Do not ask how it was right after it's over. Tomorrow morning you want to talk about it, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true. There's nothing that destroys the actual experience faster than talking about it too soon.
Right.
So, well, yes, go ahead, Brian.
No, I'm glad we covered all those basic skills. And, in the few minutes we have left, Ray, I'd really be interested in hearing a little bit more about how you came up with this curriculum or what motivated you to create this.
Well, it did evolve out of doing... basically sex therapy with couples and trying to figure out what kind of homework would create the experiences people were looking for.
Uh-huh.
And my co-author with this program, Malcolm McKay, has had many years of experience in Eastern mysticism and practices and eroticism and all that. So he certainly brought a rich heritage to our conversations as we worked on how to create things for people. And that's part of why I say, quite honestly, just to appreciate many of the things we actually crafted into little exercises are quite old. We may have westernized them, but we didn't invent them.
Right.
And so part of it was Malcolm's and Mike. I'm, more of a scientist and interested in the neurology of all this and a behavior therapist. And he had all that experience with breathing and eye gazing. And so he knew the how-to stuff. And I knew a lot of the stuff about why it ought to work. And we started trying to craft it in a way that wasn't so wrapped in a particular spiritual belief, because in some ways that's my secular scientist saying, mm-hmm. This is spiritual stuff, but it works, and it works because the nervous system is designed the way it is.
Right.
Such a good point.
So that's really how it started, and then we just began to work with couples together and reflect on how it unfolded, and we acquired a few exercises. I mean, we certainly acquired exercises from some of our colleagues who have books. So one of the things in our set of practice exercises is, if we can, we've actually reproduced them from one of our colleagues' books as opposed to write it up ourselves. Because it's like everybody knows how to do active listening, but it's kind of nice to point you toward Linda DeVillers' Love Skills, which is a great little book, and she has a great active listening exercise. And Stella Resnick, who wrote The Pleasure Zone, has a great breathing set of exercises.
Yes,
and
she really does.
We've used those from some of the other people. My favorite yoga teacher was my naturopath, and we have one of his basic yoga sequences in there because that's another pathway to how to move stuff around. And so I do like acknowledging all these other people currently alive and alive centuries ago who really are the sources of all this work. And what we've done is sort of collect it theoretically together.
And it's very valuable. Ray, thank you so much for being our guest. And we look forward to part two with you in 2 weeks on April the 8th.
And do you have a way of posting any of the exercises before we do it? I was thinking about just picking one and posting it so the audience could see. Is there a way
yes,
that people can do that?
It's very likely that by that time we can. I got a message from the executive producer for Progressive Radio Network, Jason, and so the website is, I think, about to be changed, and so I think we can do that.
If so, I'd like to post the gifting.
I agree, because we do want to talk about that, and if people could see it online.
And be able to download it in print at least. You know,
yes.
Too bad we don't have a little video demo, but we don't. Mm-hmm. But the written instructions, I think, are helpful.
Are good, yes.
Well, Ray, we look forward to seeing you again in 2 weeks.
It'll be marvelous. Thanks.
Yes, thank you again. And for remember, the Seattle Institute's website is sextx.com, S-E-X-T-X.com. You have been listening to Love, Lust, and Laughter. And this is Dr. Diana Wiley signing off with big thank yous to Dr. Elizabeth Ray Larson and my wonderful guest co-host, Brian Brewer. Bye-bye.